yourself. Life isn't about arriving. It's about becoming. And that journey is far too exciting to sit on the sidelines. If you want to share Encouragementology with a friend who needs to know they're not alone in this journey of self-discovery, you can visit encouragementology.com or anywhere you stream your content to receive this episode and all others. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram for additional encouragement throughout the week. So I challenge you this week, identify one area of your life where change is knocking, and instead of bolting the door, invited in for coffee. Embrace the discomfort, explore the possibilities, and watch how you grow. Remember, change isn't the enemy. It's the personal trainer for your life's journey. I know you can do it. Thank you for listening to Encouragementology with Kendall Boyson, where we find positive ways to handle some of life's challenges.
Stumbled through until the path was clear. That's when I found you. How I wound up here. All I needed was a rock that I can lean on.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations of programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Program Advisory Committee meets quarterly on the first Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a global audience, produced at a different location every week.
It is a lost moment in history because they were Black. And so much of that history is lost to us because the people keeping track of history weren't writing it down.
I'm Jamal Milner, the technical director of With Good Reason, produced by Virginia Humanities in Charlottesville, Virginia. Today on Sprouts, we learn about the music of some of America's greatest Black composers and musicians of Western European classical music. Thomas Jefferson fathered at least six children with Sally Hemings, who was his enslaved maid. He brought her with him to Paris for 2.5 years. While in Paris, she could have become a free woman, but negotiated with Jefferson to return to enslavement at Monticello in exchange for extraordinary privileges for herself and for freedom for her unborn children. My first guest is David McCormick, a violinist who has recreated the music of the Black fiddlers of Monticello. That included two sons of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, Beverly and Eston. It also included Jesse Scott, who was white and Pamunkey Indian and married into the Hemings family. Scott and his children played several string instruments and were known as the Scott Family Band. To my surprise, after living in Charlottesville for over 20 years, I never knew about these great musicians who were from Monticello and from the area. Why don't we know about them?
You know, so I grew up in Charlottesville too, and I didn't know about them until about 3 years ago. It is a lost moment in history. A lot of people know that Thomas Jefferson was a violinist. His daughters and his wife were also amateur musicians. But we have this lost piece of history that there is this rich fiddling tradition at Monticello and in downtown Charlottesville. Unfortunately, it's because they were Black. And so much of that history is lost to us because the people keeping track of history weren't writing it down.
Does that make it difficult for you to learn about their time period and their contributions in music? And if so, how do you figure this out?
it wasn't as easy as sitting down and reading someone's long account of the fiddlers that they encountered at Monticello. It was random newspaper articles from the Chillicothe Gazette, where Esten Hemmings ended up.
And Chillicothe's in Ohio?
In Ohio, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And going through even court records in Charlottesville, was able to find out a little bit about the lives of some of these fiddlers and just piece it together little by little. And even some of the longtime historians of Monticello who aren't musicians hadn't noticed that they were actually staring at pieces of music that were in some of the records about these fiddlers.
Who would have written the actual musical notes in some of those records?
So a lot of my research does in fact center on pieces that are in Jefferson's collection that the fiddlers at Monticello might have played. We don't know for sure except for one piece. There's one piece that Jefferson actually wrote down in his own hand called Money Musk.
Okay.
And when he writes something down in his own hand, that's a pretty good indication that that was one of his favorites, because he doesn't do it very often. And we know that Esten Hemmings, when he was in Chillicothe, was famous for playing Money Musk. It was like his tune. And so we have that connection. And that was what inspired me to keep looking in Jefferson's collection for other pieces like that. This performance of Money Musk includes clarinet and violin and an instrument called the Yankee Viol.
Okay. What is that?
It is basically a cello.
Okay.
It's kind of a fat cello.
Okay. Is it tuned similarly?
It's tuned slightly lower.
Okay.
But not as low as a bass.
Okay.
But it was this common instrument of the dance band at this time. And you're also going to hear an instrument called the bones.
Okay.
Now, this was not an Esten Hemmings band. This was an innovation of this group of people that I got together. Ben Hunter, this incredible fiddler, really wanted to try bones on a few of these pieces. And it worked so well, we decided to do it in performance, even though we don't have any indication that Esten Hemmings and his band played with bones. But it just sounded so great this way, and it's such a cool instrument. In the time period, it would have been actual bones.
Well, let's check out this performance of Money Musk.
What's really cool about the performance piece of this project was getting to hear what this music really sounded like.
Right.
In the instrumentation of the day, using materials of the day. So for instance, my violin was strung with sheep gut strings.
Okay.
And that gives us some indication of what this sounded like. And it's a little bit separated from the fiddling tradition of today, even though that's an unbroken tradition. Fiddlers today don't use gut strings for the most part, for instance, and they don't use clarinets that have the 18th century key system, which was a simpler key system. And so we're hearing things in a new way and really getting to inhabit that sound world.
In his notes on the state of Virginia, Thomas Jefferson often degrades or refuses to acknowledge the abilities of black people to master European culture. Did he also have these views concerning black musical ability?
Oh, absolutely. There are two quotes about music in Notes on the State of Virginia. One of them is just simply introducing the reader to the banjo and noting its African origin. That's a helpful quote, actually, to historians. The other quote is not helpful and is kind of awful, where he basically says African Americans can really only manage to sort of compose a small catch and are good at learning music by ear, but don't have the ability to read off the page. And he was so wrong about that.
Okay, right.
He couldn't have been more wrong. And he was faced with that contradiction when he was in Paris. He heard this famous Afro-European violinist George Bridgetower, who was only 9 years old and who was playing circles around everybody in Europe at the time, and who also ended up being a composer.
Okay.
And his own sons. He had three sons who were fiddlers. And we know among the Scott and Hemmings family fiddlers that some of them knew how to read music. And we know that Jesse Scott was a composer.
Okay.
So all that's refuted.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, that's one of the things we know. Thomas Jefferson had contradictory life, if you put it that way, I guess.
Yeah.
He would express certain things in the public arena, but as you see and read, and historians have found out in the personal arena, he didn't quite act in those same ways.
Yeah, you know, I don't think he was stupid. I think he knew that he was wrong.
Right. And being a politician too, there's an aspect of what you have to advertise to your political group.
Absolutely.
What were some of the European art music compositions that you know that they played?
Yeah, this was maybe the thing that was most surprising in my research. I was expecting to find a few minuets and waltzes here and there. I was not expecting to find large swaths of European dance suites from the most popular operas of the day. So we've got works by Meyerbeer and by Auber. The Meyerbeer is Robert le Diable, is the opera that the Scots played from. There aren't a lot of dance pieces in these operas, so we can be relatively certain that they played certain pieces from those operas. And they're not easy.
Right.
They are really complicated pieces of music, even when you strip them down to their bare essentials. And it tells you something about the talent of these fiddlers.
Okay. In your research, one of the things that was most fascinating to me is you have a picture of the Scots, and they're at a party. And at this party, they are with the white partygoers, but in the foreground, you can see the actual black people who are the servants who are working. So it appears from that photo that the Scots were in some sort of special caste, comparatively speaking, to the black servant class. Tell me about how the Scots navigated the South as traveling musicians.
Their story is incredible, and that photograph is amazing.
Right.
I cannot stop staring at that photograph. 3 years later, I'm still staring at it, just kind of amazed. They're at the Cool Springs Barbecue Club. They are standing shoulder to shoulder with Confederate generals.
Wow.
You know, who had just finished fighting a war to keep them in bondage.
Right.
And, you know, part of it is just that they were part white.
Okay.
And part of it is that they're musicians.
Right.
There's this sort of special class because musicians and certain other professions, you had to be able to inhabit that sort of white cultured world, right? You had to learn these European opera dances. You had to dress a certain way to play for that fancy ball. It's the same for certain other jobs like valets and so forth.
Right.
Had to dress the part, had to act a certain way. And it elevated their social status because they were able to do it.
Right. When we spoke earlier, you told me about a piece called Valse Infernal. What is special about this piece of music, and why did you perform it at the Rotunda?
This is one of the opera tunes that we know the Scott family played. And this is one of the tunes where I was like trying to strip it down to its basics so that it would be more like a fiddle tune. And you can only strip it down so far. It's a pretty complex piece of music. And the version that I ultimately came up with that I performed at the Rotunda was actually really hard.
Okay.
It was really virtuosic. And I want people to hear it and understand this is what the Scott family was capable of. This is some serious tunage here.
Here, we're going to check out a little bit of Valse Infernal.
There are certainly hard fiddle tunes, right? With, you know, fast breakneck speed pieces. This really was kind of a shock to me. And actually, the first time I played it in rehearsal for the rest of the band, they all looked up and went, "What are you doing? What are you playing? What is that?" You know, it was an unexpected find, for sure. And it's without a doubt something the Scots played. And it was very popular in its day because Liszt had made a piano transcription of it. So it was known as this piece of virtuoso music.
And that's Franz Liszt, the great pianist and composer.
Yeah.
All right.
He made a piano transcription of it that's wildly difficult.
Well, David, thank you so very much for speaking with us today about the Black Fiddlers of Monticello.
It's been my pleasure.
David McCormick is a violinist, executive director of Early Music America, and artistic director of the Early Music Access Project. You're listening to Sprouts, radio from the grassroots. a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of global interest. I'm Jamal Milner, your host today on the program With Good Reason, produced in Charlottesville by Virginia Humanities. Today's episode is called Black and Fine, about the great but little-known black musicians and composers in early America. Justin Holland was a gifted musician, abolitionist, and Freemason. He was born free in Norfolk County, Virginia in 1819. Holland navigated the complexities of race and class to become one of the most respected musicians of his generation. I spoke with classical guitarist Ernie Jackson about his discovery of American maestro Justin Holland.
Thank you for having me. I can't tell you what an honor it is to be here speaking with you and promoting the music of scholars from a time then that we weren't being referred to as scholars, but we realized they left their legacy for us to discover and continue on with. So I discovered Justin Holland my first semester of my freshman year of college at Wagner College on Staten Island. You know, I'm born in Manhattan, raised in Brooklyn. And so I found my way to Staten Island with this fantastic guitar teacher, Ed Brown. And Ed Brown happens to be an expert on American guitar music, because a lot of people just focus on European music, like that's the standard. But there's so much here in the United States that it's just not being played. So he took it upon himself to discover American music for classical guitar. And he came across Justin Holland. So my very first concert in the fall of 1983, there was a program that he put together, and my classmate, John Salvaggio, played a piece called Last Waltzes of a Lunatic. Sometimes you'll see it known as Last Waltzes of a Madman, Last Waltzes of a Lunatic. And so John played that, and Ed Brown was explaining that this music was written by a black man named Justin Holland in the 1800s and how rare that was and what a find. So that was the first time I had ever heard the music and the name. I had just graduated from my Jimi Hendrix phase to my Al Di Meola fusion John McLaughlin phase. You know, and getting into my King Crimson phase. And so I was being the quintessential guitarist of the 80s. Okay. So that's where I was headed, you know, black classical guitarist who could play everything.
Well, could you describe to us what is the American guitar style? And did Justin Holland contribute to the dissemination of this style to the rest of the guitar players in the 19th century?
The American style is different because it blends something. So from the European side, it's the aristocratic nature of it. It's a social construct. It's coming from the style brise in the style of.
Okay.
Right? America has their songs that they would sing in parlors. The sophistication of it all. That's the difference. So again, when your listeners listen to Home Sweet Home and Variations, you're going to hear that familiar thing. There's no place like home. It is just brilliant. It's just brilliant.
Thank you.
What I tell you.
Yeah.
Man. What I tell you.
Yes.
It's that second movement that gets me, where the melody is in the bass. Oh, come on, man. So your thumb is working.
I was reading in Justin Holland's Method for Guitar, and he also seems to be like Thor and some of the older composers about how you should utilize your thumb on your fret hand. You're not really supposed to use it to play bass like I do often in blues and jazz, for example. How hard is that, playing all those bass notes like that?
Let's just say I leave it up to other people to So a lot of the music that you'll hear from Justin Holland, his arrangements, and remember, these are all arrangements for the most part. He only wrote like 33 original pieces.
Okay.
But like the arrangements are in the European style, but they are American songs.
Justin Holland was born to free parents in Norfolk County, Virginia, and his parents were successful with farming, but they die when he's a young man, and he moves to Massachusetts to continue his education and his education in music as well. What type of environment would Justin Holland find in Massachusetts in the middle 19th century?
Is there something to be said for the settlement of Quakers in certain areas that maybe black people sought solace in, that they could thrive?
Holland attended Oberlin College from 1841 to 1843, and Oberlin actually admitted some of its first black students in 1835. It would have been a similar type of environment that he was familiar with in Massachusetts concerning race and racial difference. Holland left Oberlin due to his inability to afford to pay tuition. But during this time, he begins to get a lot of work as both a musician and, I think, as an arranger.
Yeah.
Ernie, what did he do?
As an arranger. And I think the best thing about it, as I was thinking about this just last night, can we just say that Justin Holland worked remote?
Yes.
Can we just say, if a publisher sending you music to arrange by post, what they call it back then, by post, and then you're sending it back and getting paid, you're working remote.
How popular was the guitar during the 19th century?
A very popular instrument. Why? It's portable. The guitar, coming over here, Stauffer, the person who trained, you know, C.F. Martin how to build guitars, like taking that design.
And C.F. Martin was the original Martin on Martin guitars from Nashville,
right,
Pennsylvania, that mostly nowadays are used by the flat pickers,
yep,
finger pickers. I own,
yep,
one too.
Right?
Martin, come on.
Come on, come over here, Martin. Let's talk. So that was a small body guitar. It's still societal, though. And the reason I keep saying it's societal, because who were the better guitar players back then?
I would assume women.
Women. Yeah. And he did teach at the state. He did teach in these places. He taught societal people guitar. He taught women.
Right. So after performing for a while and, mm-hmm, going out on the road and really perfecting this Holland material, you then enter the arena of the guitar gunslingers, or the competitions that take place in music. Oh, people always tell you, music's not competitive. It's not this competitive thing. But obviously, humans are competitive. So in various forms of music, there are musical competitions. And so classical music has them, but there also happens to be in like this American rural music traditions. We have like fiddle contests and guitar picking, finger picking, flat picking contests. So, Ernie, I understand that you participated in some of those contests coming from Justin Holland to, you know, Nashville. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, you know, so when I would go to the Chet Atkins convention, I am the only black person there. Let's just call it for what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a three-day thing. The convention is like almost 24 hours. Like you could be in the lobby, people are playing, exchanging licks and stuff like that. I used to do the version, and you will hear this piece done by Michael Vescones. La Traviata by Verdi is another hard one. Now that's a straight European from an opera, right? That one, that kind of flows, Right? Then it gets ridiculous. Okay. So I started playing that, and they're sitting there like, huh? Because it's the kind of thing that people who are referred to as thumb pickers, the Merle Travis style, the Chet Atkins style, the thumb pickers, which is not far from a classical style. It's just that they use a thumb pick and maybe one, maybe the index and second finger at most. If they use the third finger, it's rare. Okay? So we're kind of close cousins, classical and thumb pickers. All they hear is a really cool melody played finger style. So even though we're two different families, the common ground is finger style. So when I'm in Nashville, I'm playing with these guys. They play with their thumb. Because when they play with their thumb, they're able to, they're basically using all five fingers. Once I'm down there, it's common ground. It really doesn't matter what beliefs you have, but when you start playing stuff and you're just cool exchanging music, that's what it's about. And the way you win contests is to always play something nobody's heard before. My same teacher, Ed Brown, said to me one day, just in casual, oh, hey, Ernie, they mentioned Justin Holland in the classical guitar book. So the classical guitar book is this gigantic book that features all the great classical guitar players throughout time. So I went to the music store and I happened to see the book and I looked inside. My teacher did not sell it properly. There was this picture of Justin Holland and a picture of my book. I think it was the 6th edition. He had never been in it before.
Wow.
We had this great store in the village, Matt Umanoff Guitars. That was a legendary guitar store.
I remember that store.
So I was in there and I saw, oh, here's the book. I'm like, oh, wait a minute. Oh, I bought it right away. I still have it, here. And so for my 40th birthday, my accountant, he was working with my hero, Nile Rodgers. And
all
so
right.
He arranged for me on my birthday to go meet Nile Rodgers. So I go up to Nile and I bring Nile presents. I bring him a copy of my book. I bring a magazine for him to sign because he was on the cover. And he's going through the classic guitar book. And you know what he said? He said, if I had had this book before Justin Holland was in it, I would never play classical guitar because there's no black people in it. That was deep. Getting that from my hero, for him to say, I had done a great thing. You know, and so even if it was just one person in there, he would have thought about playing classical guitar.
Wow, right? Oftentimes we need to see someone who may look like us or be from where we're from or have some commonality with us to inspire us to do something different. And humans can do almost anything any other humans can do. And so seeing someone do it is very encouraging and inspiring. Did you find that in your playing?
It was just weird for me because I didn't look at it that way. But, that's the kind of thing like my grandparents who raised me would say. Some families will say, why are you playing that music for? That's not our music. I said, I'm playing it because I can play it. And so instead of perpetuating the stereotype, this is the norm. Like people will say to us, well, you're the exception. It's like, no, I'm the norm. I am the norm, my friend. I can play this. Full disclosure, I didn't tell you this last time, but I have to confess. Do you know the one style of music I can't play is the blues? I am so hard.
Wow. All right. See? Stereotypes. There you go. Unfortunately, the form of music I can play is the blues. So in some of the biographical information on Holland by James M. Trotter, he describes some of the social conditions that Justin Holland was able to make for himself. And he sounds like he was actually like a successful American entrepreneur.
They didn't care. It was at Brainerd & Sons. That was the publishing company.
Right.
Brainerd. They didn't really care. I was like, this guy's good. And nobody sent him a letter. Hey, this is a black guy.
All the notes are black.
Seriously. All the notes are black. That's all I know. It's all white people, the notes are black. And so it's just a different time. And I just think that it's a kind of like a dream situation to work.
Right. Like you said, he was remote work before the internet.
That was a thing. Work from home.
Ernie, This has been amazing. I thank you so very much for taking your time to talk with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Ernie Jackson is a professor and co-director of music production at Queensborough Community College. His latest recording is The Music of Justin Holland. It'll be released by Minnesota Public Radio. That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to Black and Fine, produced by With Good Reason. Special thanks to our guests David McCormick and Ernie Jackson. The music of this show was used with their permission. The With Good Reason production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and our executive producer, Sarah McConnell. Our podcast can be found at withgoodreasonradio.org. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the globe. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase nationally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's URSULA@pacifica.org. I'm Jamal Milner in Charlottesville. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
I'm Molly, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Join me, Melissa Lesniak, creator and host of That Vegan Show, this Friday, February 28th at 11 a.m., where I interview two of the founders of Ratway Sanctuary, Lionel and Laura. They tell us about the rats they care for